You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez.
It's as if our home has been through a tornado for 3 years, day and night.
That's Bahare Sharghi. Her husband, Imad, is held in Iran's Evin prison, his fate seemingly tied to ongoing tensions between Washington and Tehran.
Talks are underway in Vienna to potentially return the U.S. to a landmark 2015 nuclear agreement with Iran. But those efforts could be complicated by the country's continued imprisonment of four Americans, including international businessman Imad Sharghi.
I hope their big talks go well. I really do, for the sake of both countries. But I just beg that the little people like us are not forgotten. So, please, don't forget these men. Not only don't forget, but bring them home.
Imad Sharghi and his wife were in Iran as tourists, visiting relatives. They had nothing to do with nuclear negotiations. But geopolitical forces have transformed their family's lives.
I mean, our dad is an incredible man, and he's the most present and loving father and person.
He has health issues and has for a long time. And then during COVID, like, it's hard not to constantly feel anxious.
He's an innocent American citizen who's unable to come home to his family and unable to come back to the States.
And Imad Sharghi is not alone. He's one of more than three dozen Americans held captive in countries around the world. Not by groups of terrorists or paramilitary groups, but in an increasing trend, held by foreign governments.
Siamak Namazi, Bagar Namazi, his father, Murad Tabaz, Trevor Reed, Paul Whelan in Russia, the long list of Americans in China, and on and on and on.
That's Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian. He was also on that list himself. In 2014, Rezaian and his wife were imprisoned by the Iranian government. Jason was held for 544 days.
In a number of these cases that we hear about in Iran and other authoritarian countries, 544 days is kind of the best case scenario.
And Jason Rezaian is now on a mission to keep the same thing from happening to others. He says the U.S. government has to treat these situations with life and death urgency and less like diplomatic disputes.
You have to deal with each one of these cases individually. You have to resolve them. And the political costs of not resolving them are usually higher than the costs of offering some kind of concession to bring Americans home.
On this week's show, we'll hear Jason Rezaian's story, which he's turned into a book and now a podcast, on being held hostage and why he thinks it's so essential that the public, the media, and the U.S. government evolve the meaning of that word.
I'm Jason Rezaian. I'm an opinions writer for The Washington Post.
And I'm Yegane Rezaian, the wife, and I work for the Committee to Protect Journalists.
Jason, in 2009, you were freelance. And still, at that point, not heavily experienced, but you knew you wanted to be a foreign correspondent. You decided to move to Iran, one of the toughest places in the world to go.
Yeah, and I think when you say it like that, it sounds kind of reckless. But I have to rewind a little bit and tell you that my dad was born and raised in Iran, moved to the U.S., married my mom, who's an American woman. I grew up in a predominantly Iranian-American family in the Bay Area, and I was always really fascinated with the culture. And when I was 25, I had the opportunity to travel to Iran for the first time, and that started a kind of love affair with the place and the people. So I was going back and forth pretty regularly. And to augment these trips and to offset the costs of these trips, I worked in my dad's Persian rug shop. And one thing led to another. He convinced me that I should open my own shop. I opened a shop right off of Union Square in San Francisco in May of 2008. And I don't think I need to remind listeners what happened in the months that followed. I went bankrupt soon after that. And I had a decision to make. Am I going to flail around in one of the most expensive cities in the world, or am I going to chase my dream to become a foreign correspondent? And I chose the latter.
All right. Yegi, can you remember the first time you met Jason?
Of course, it was love at first sight.
Oh, okay. Then for me, then say no more.
We met in Dubai, in UAE, right after 2009 presidential election in Iran, which turned quite bloody, lots of street protests. So I was vacationing to be away from those ugly, painful scenes for a couple of weeks. And Jason was there because right before that, he was in Iran reporting. And when the election turned violent, the government asked foreign journalists to leave the country. So he was in Dubai, right behind Iran's borders, waiting for the government to show him the green light so he could go back and continue his reporting.
And Jason, what did it look like from your seat?
I mean, she walked in the room after a shopping trip from the Dubai Mall and, you know, put the shopping bags down, and the light was blinding. I was struck from the first moments, and hanging out for a few hours with some mutual acquaintances, and the friend who had brought me to this gathering and I left, and as soon as the door closed, she paused and kind of grabbed me and said, "You're going to marry that girl." And I said, "I think you're right." And here we are 12 years later, and, you know, a lot of weird stuff has happened since, but we're still together.
Married for 8 years, and now we have a baby.
That's, even without all the other stuff, that's an amazing enough story all on its own. You get married. You get a job right after that with the Washington Post?
I got the job with the Post a few months before we got married. I think it probably made me more of a viable husband and suitor from her dad's point of view, that I had a real job with a real major company and international brand like the Post. So I started working for the Post the spring of 2012, and we got married in the spring of 2013.
Well, let's fast forward to July 2014. What happens?
I had just returned from covering a round of nuclear negotiations in Vienna. It was the first time that I'd been allowed to go and report from another country on an Iran story. It felt like I was making real progress in my work. Yegi and I had been married for just over a year. We were about to take a trip back to the Bay Area to pick up Yegi's green card. I mean, we had done all the paperwork from afar. Our lives were established now, and I finally felt at 38 years old that I had arrived at a place of stability and prosperity to a certain extent, and the future seemed extremely bright until we were arrested at gunpoint, leaving our apartment, going to a surprise birthday party on the night of July 22nd, and that changed our lives forever.
We locked up and headed downstairs in the elevator. When the doors opened in the parking garage, there were two guys standing there. One of them was pointing a gun right at me. Without even thinking, I reached into my pocket.
You were trying to take her phone out, and those guys thought you have a gun. So they got physical with you.
That's a clip from 544 Days, a Spotify original podcast hosted by Jason. Yegi, what did that moment look like from your point of view? You were far more familiar with post-revolutionary Iran than your young husband was.
Unfortunately, that's true. I think I always used to tell Jason that when you were born and you grew up in one of these authoritarian places, you always know of someone whose loved ones or a family member has been arrested, or you hear these stories on and off. It's like a familiar theme. So I still remember that when they raided our house, and within those first few minutes, I was trying to make sure that I get Jason's blood pressure medicine to him, because I knew this is going to be a lengthy process. And he was trying to calm me down by saying, "This is a mistake. Someone made a mistake. This is going to go away within a few minutes. They're going to find out that we haven't done anything." But in my mind, as much as I really appreciated him trying to calm me down by saying these things, I was like, no, Jason, this is not going to go away. This is not going to go away. No one has made a mistake. These guys are here to, they are going through our safe box with all of our passports, taking everything. And within a few minutes, 30 guys are in our house filming us. Some of them were ninjas, like wearing ninja clothing. Their face and everything is masked. Everyone wore surgical masks, although it's a long time before COVID. So I knew this is not going to go away anytime soon. And then they put us in a van, blindfolded us. They put handcuffs on Jason. He was sitting in the row in front of me, and I was sitting in the back with a female guard. But she let us hold our hands, and I tried, because we got to our destination 5 minutes later. It's like that quick. And I thought to myself, oh my God, I lived for 30 years in a neighborhood that is only 5 minutes away from Evin prison. So this must be it. We are going there. And I tried to write on the palm of his hand, Evin, spell Evin, but obviously he was so stressed that I don't think he got it.
From the story I just heard, it sounds like Yegi understood how much trouble you were in, and you didn't, from that reassurance. Was that just husbandly duty, or did you really think that you weren't in as much trouble as you were?
I think it was a combination of things. Husbandly duty, compounded by the fact that I am a habitually optimistic person. I think that I fooled myself into thinking that things would work out, but you know, having the Washington Post kind of knowing that I worked for them and that they would not take it sitting down made me feel confident.
I assume that initially you're not able to get your story straight, talk to each other, all that. You're being questioned separately. What did they tell you was happening, Yegi?
They were not telling us anything. Just to add to the point, I don't think Jason got anything wrong except believing that you must have done something really bad, something wrong to go through such a story. In his mind, he's a very law-abiding citizen of Iran as much as he's a citizen of the United States. He hasn't done anything. And the important thing is, on the same day that these guys raided our house, that same morning, the Ministry of Islamic Guidance and Culture, which is in charge of issuing press credentials for journalists, both domestic and international, renewed our press cards.
So
for a year. So we were really reassured that everything is good. We got our press card. They did not question us on any of the stories that we wrote. We are fine. They are happy with us. And then at 8 p.m., they raided our house. But they were not telling us anything. They were saying they're going to take us somewhere for a few hours or maybe a few days, which immediately made me think, okay, few months. And they're looking for some answers and some clarities. And when they reach those decisions, they would let us go.
Well, I'm going to assume there's no Persian Miranda warning. Is there any obligation to tell you what they were charging you with, what they were looking for, what they thought you did? Nothing?
No, and I don't think that they had a concept of what they were going to charge us with until they had months to, you know, cobble a story together based on high-pressure interrogations, right? One of the other things that we had to relinquish that night was the passwords to our social media and email accounts. So they had access to our emails, and you know, they went about printing things out. My brother, as soon as he found out about this, and it was within 24 hours of our arrest, that the Washington Post knew, because a colleague of ours went to our house, saw that, you know, it had been boarded up, contacted the Post. Post contacted my brother. My brother is a smart guy. He had the presence of mind to have our Gmail accounts. And because those accounts were no longer accessible, they had a very limited amount of emails to work with. Again, they use that as an accusation. Who is your brother? How come he's so important that he can get your key? I mean, in the vacuum of the Revolutionary Guard's interrogation process, anything is a crime. You know, I joke now that if you have a Gmail address and speak a second language, you too could be convicted of spying in Iran. And it really is that arbitrary.
Mm-hmm. Is there any obligation to tell anybody else? We don't have diplomatic relations with Iran. I assume there's an interest section. Who was handling an American who gets arrested in a country we don't have interest in?
The Swiss.
The Swiss.
And so that's the protecting power, has been since 1980. And they were, at the behest of the State Department, asking for access to me, as they do in every one of these cases. Iran's response is always the same. This person is not a dual national. They're an Iranian citizen. We don't recognize dual nationality. And so that's their way of keeping people outside of the prison and away from the person. My interrogators told me, the Swiss have come looking for you. We told them that you don't want to see them. I was like, you know, I'd like to have the opportunity to tell that to them myself. But, you know, this idea that Iran officially doesn't acknowledge dual nationality, it sounds really good. You know, former Foreign Minister Javad Zarif would come to the U.S. and make this pronouncement every time he was asked questions about me or other dual nationals who were held. But ultimately, we are an Iranian national until the day that they're ready to pull off a trade with the other country. And then all of that goes out the window, right? You know, I was traded as an American. I was held as an American. If it quacks like a duck, right?
The world, or your world, kicks into action. Your family is in harness. The Washington Post is in your corner. Officials in the Obama administration have your back as well. Do you have any awareness of what's going on?
No.
In the opening months, absolutely not. I mean, I was sealed off completely for 49 days in solitary confinement. Yegi spent the entirety of her time in Evin in solitary confinement, 72 days. So we had no idea at that point. But after I came out of solitary and after Yegi was released, little bits and pieces of information would appear. You know, maybe a sympathetic guard would say something about a statement that had been made. Muhammad Ali had put out a statement on my birthday in 2015. That kind of was a turning point in that, you know, guards and interrogators started looking at me a little bit differently. Muhammad Ali isn't just an American hero. He's a Muslim hero, right? And so that was one example of that. You know, we had appeared on Anthony Bourdain's show, Parts Unknown, a few weeks before we were arrested. We were interviewed. I was praying that they would not decide to cut that segment from the show out of concerns for our safety, because I understood and believed to my core then and now that the farther and wider our names were known, the better off our chances were of getting out.
Did you make the Bourdain show?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I don't want to speak for Yegi, and she's right here so she can speak for herself, but I think it's one of the proudest moments of our lives.
Do you like it? You happy here?
Look, I'm at a point now after 5 years where I miss certain things about home. I miss my buddies. I miss burritos. I miss having certain beverages with my buddies and burritos in certain types of establishments. But I love it. I love it and I hate it, you know, but it's home. It's become home.
Are you optimistic about the future?
Yeah, especially if this nuclear deal finally happens. Yeah. Very much, actually. I remember on day 40-something, I was still in solitary. The woman next door to my cell found out who I was, like I was the wife of this American spy. And it was during Anga, so Iran's president, President Rouhani, and Foreign Minister Javad Zarif had a meeting with heads of press in New York City, and Marty Baron was there.
Marty Baron was executive editor of the Washington Post at the time.
So Marty asked the question from President Rouhani, and I'm sitting in my cell crying while the woman next door had a TV in her cell. So she raised the volume and I heard the name Marty Baron, Washington Post, our correspondent, and his wife were in prison.
I would like to say to you personally that we believe that he deserves his freedom, and we ask the government of Iran to release him. And I want to ask you how the Iranian government can justify imprisoning a good journalist. I think you know he's a good journalist and a good person, and having him imprisoned.
So it's like there is something going on in the outside world, because before that they were telling us that it was reported in both domestic and international news that you guys were killed in a car accident, and that's it. No one's caring anymore. And you, when you are in a hole like that in solitary, you believe it. You're like, fine, probably that's very true, because no one is knocking the door asking for me, because you don't know what is happening outside. I always tell people that solitary is like a grave. You are alive, but they put you in a grave while you're still alive. But it was very interesting to hear that few seconds of that interview, because I kept saying, oh God, why is Washington Post not doing anything for my husband? So it was really reassuring listening to that, hearing that.
You get released, Yegi.
Yes.
Why? What did they tell you? And what begins, as far as your experience of this whole thing, once you're outside the doors of the prison?
Oh, it was very different. Being held inside, at some point I was relieved because I was like, I'm in the same situation as Jason is. But first of all, they released me under house arrest with multiple conditions. Like I couldn't work anymore. I couldn't be in touch with any of my colleagues in the media. I couldn't have online or social media presence. So it was very limiting. Also, I was not supposed to go to any government offices and advocate on Jason's behalf, which I abide by it for 2 months. And then I was like, this is impossible. I have to go to the foreign ministry. I have to go to judiciary. I have to go and meet Judge Salavati and demand to see my husband, have visitations with him.
Did you perceive that doing any of these things were a risk to your status being outside the walls?
Oh, absolutely. But I think it got to a point that I didn't have anything else to lose. They would either take me back to prison, which they have tried again multiple times as a scare tactic to take me back and make me put prison blues on again and interrogate me and keeping me for an hourly basis, saying, okay, you are back in here.
You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez, and I'm talking with Yegane and Jason Rezaian. They were both incarcerated in Iran's Evin prison in 2014. Before the break, we heard how Yegi, after 72 days in prison, was released without Jason. Is there an evolution of what the Iranians say you've been arrested for? Do we finally get some sort of straight story, or is this a constantly moving target through these months and months of confinement?
Well, initially, you know, those first few months, they are saying that we're doing an investigation, right? We're investigating complaints about what this person was up to under the guise of being a journalist. And as time went on, it became clearer and clearer that they were going to charge me with crimes against Iran's national security, including spying for the U.S. government, conspiring with an enemy state, the U.S. government. For a time, they were saying that I was conspiring with Israel, which carries a death sentence with it, propaganda against the regime, insulting the supreme leader. I mean, there was a long list of charges. Some of them were dropped before my trial. But ultimately, when we talk about charges in these cases, and, you know, I talk about this in the context of my case, but also, for example, in the case of Danny Fenster, the journalist who was in Myanmar and just released, we shouldn't rehash and repeat all of the charges, because the charges are almost always completely bogus, right? Rather than having a headline of Washington Post journalist accused of spying or convicted of spying in Iran, it should be Washington Post journalist being held hostage on bogus charges, right? And I will keep fanning the flames on that conversation until we turn the tide on that and colleagues in the media realize that there's a better way to report on these stories.
In your podcast series, 544 Days, we hear from the many people in this hastily assembled orbit of interests. There's your mother, Mary.
Jason loves Iran. He would never do anything to hurt Iran, to bring shame to Iran. It is my intention to come to Iran.
Your brother, Ali.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the first fair bit, we were like, all right, you know, Jason's been brought in to talk before. We didn't know the extent of what had happened at your house.
Marty Baron, who not only is an editor who has to look out for his people, but is also defending broader principles about our business and what it exists for and what it exists to do and why you should be protected.
We didn't want to be so belligerent that the Iranians would just say, you know, they're not going to do anything and they're offended by what we were saying. But over time, you know, it became clear that we should be even more and more forceful.
And members of a Washington administration trying to negotiate a treaty with the Iranians at the same time as they're trying to win your release.
And the last thing in the world we wanted was to see you pass away under those circumstances. And believe me, we kept making that point to the Iranians that if that did happen, everything was going to go to hell in the handbasket.
Their stories are fascinating because you don't know about any of this. So we hear your reflections, and simultaneously, there's this world of activity going on from these different points of view. Did you get to, in effect, recontextualize, re-experience, re-understand what this was all about? Because you, in effect, weren't there for it for the first time when it first happened.
So, yes. And, you know, when I was released, I had a lot of ideas, a lot of anger, frustrations about what the government especially was and wasn't doing, what the Post, you know, I needed to understand when they got involved, right? What my brother and my mom were doing in those earliest days. And I say that in the first episode, you know, if you have a loved one that gets locked up on the other side of the world, listen up. I mean, you know, they're going to get out one day and they're going to want to know what you did for them, right? I mean, that's just the God's honest truth.
There was one goal. I mean, I guess that was made it really kind of easy. If you step back and say, I don't have to pay attention to any of this other stuff, right? There's one thing that's going on here.
My brother, Ollie, was, I think, a really important piece of the pre-Jason puzzle. He had never had experience doing this kind of advocacy on any issue, but recognized really quickly that to win my release, he was going to need help. And he was going to need help from important people.
So when you think about somebody and you think about these people as people, right? They've got a family, they've got kids. Now, maybe they think that they're hot. I'm not talking about anybody in particular, right? And you're just like, eh, they're a person. They've got power that I need to be able to get them to use on my behalf. And that's the way I went about it.
And I think those efforts started slowly with a group of Iranian expats, journalists, human rights advocates who were advising him. And when he didn't see any positive action in our case come out of that, he started on pounding on doors in Washington and was able to get himself in front of some very, very important figures within the Obama administration. My mom, when I was arrested, she was told not to go to Iran, that it was unsafe for her. And I think she listened to that advice for several months. But when things weren't working out and I was being held longer and longer and longer, she finally threw caution to the wind, stepped on a plane and flew to Tehran, where she began agitating and advocating wherever she could.
The experience of doing that felt strange. You know, I've always tended to be somewhat of a private person, and yet this was a matter of life and death, and so I had to reach in to find other rusty parts of myself to do my share.
And that included, you know, showing up at government offices, showing up at the Revolutionary Court, talking to the judge many times, trying to get him to release me on bail, trying to convince them to give me better living conditions while I was in jail, and even showing up at events and holding signs. I mean, this is not something that anybody in Iran does.
So we were ushered into this building with cameras on the outside. And there were a couple of guys, and one of them said to me in English, "We saw you on TV. We saw you on BBC. Why did you go there?" And I said, "Because this is taking too long. My son is innocent, and I want to see him." And we had a back and forth, and I'm pounding on the table, and I'm looking him straight in the eye, which I know Iranian women of my age would not do. So I wasn't playing the part that they expected me to play.
During the nuclear negotiations in 2014, Obama administration's officials decided to open up a channel of negotiations over the freedom of myself and several other Americans who were being held in Iran. And Secretary of State John Kerry and Wendy Sherman, who was the lead nuclear negotiator, tasked Brett McGurk, who at the time was President Obama's special envoy in the fight against ISIS, to lead the negotiations over a prisoner swap. Those were done separate from the nuclear negotiations in different locations secretly, and they went on for about 14 months. Brett McGurk is someone who at the time had a really important political portfolio that he was dealing with. And so, you know, adding secret negotiations to his to-do list was not something that he initially wanted to take on. But because it was a direct order, as he says, he did it willingly and with a lot of flair and success, ultimately.
The Iranians wanted this massive trade of much more people that they considered that we were holding unjustly, which, of course, we weren't. And we, based on their own principle of reciprocity, we had kind of culled down to seven people held in American prisons or who were on parole, who were like about to get out anyway, kind of what we considered almost freebies.
He is one of the people in the podcast who I interview who I've gotten to know and really formed a relationship with since my release. Almost all of the officials that we interview for the podcast are in the Biden administration now in higher jobs than they were during the Obama years. Brett is now the National Security Council's coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to interview all these folks well before the 2020 election. As fond as I am of many of them, and I think they are of me, I'm pretty sure that I wouldn't have been able to interview them or at least get the types of interviews that we did for the podcast now that they're back on the job.
When Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Zarif were shouting at each other so loud in a dining room that Secretary Kerry's kind of main personal aide had to walk in and say, like, the whole room next door can hear you guys shouting at each other.
And we had pretty incredible access to meet a lot of those folks in the administration and unspool a lot of this story and find out what actually happened, what was being said, who did what.
Did knowing that encourage you retrospectively about that time? Were you reassured that people were working hard to get you out? Because there must have been days when you were by yourself in a cell where you feel hopeless, abandoned.
Yes, in terms of, I am always appreciative of all of those people who worked in the Obama administration, personally to the president and from top to bottom on the assistant, anyone. But no, in the sense that I can't believe after 40-something years of not having direct relationship with Iran, they finally had an open window with the Iranian officials. They were meeting them every week in a different city like Vienna or Geneva, and it still took that long. And it's also really sad that all of those efforts went out the window right when the next administration came to power.
For me, one of the big frustrations happened right at the end, right before my release. It was probably 4 or 5 days before I was released. Two American naval vessels strayed into Iranian waters and were seized. And the ship members were taken into Iranian custody, taken to an island in the Persian Gulf, held there. They were paraded on television, and I'm thinking to myself in my cell, oh my God, you know, if there was anything that was about to happen in terms of me being released, all of that's going to go out the window, because now there's, you know, multiple active service people being held by the same people that are holding me. And that was resolved in less than 24 hours. And these people, whether they did it intentionally or not, did break a very serious law. You know, armed American vessels in Iranian waters, right? Juxtapose that with what I was supposedly accused of doing without any evidence. And we have very clear evidence of their transgression, accidental or not. And John Kerry picked up the phone, talked to Foreign Minister Zarif, and essentially said, hey, look, if you don't get these guys out of your custody and on their way, this whole nuclear deal is going to fall apart. Why couldn't that happen with me 530-something days before that? And that's not a question that anybody's been able to answer for me, and one that I will keep asking, not just in my case, but in all these other cases, because there are so many instances where, you know, if the person is deemed important enough, or what they have on their person is important enough, or the sensitivity of the moment is important enough, these things can get resolved very quickly. And I would like to see the government spring into action much more quickly on behalf of Americans who are being held hostage by governments around the world.
Yegi Rezaian is a journalist who works for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Great to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Jason Rezaian is a global opinions writer for The Washington Post. He was the paper's correspondent in Tehran before he was arrested and held in an Iranian prison for 18 months. He wrote about that experience in his 2019 book, Prisoner. And in his new podcast, 544 Days, Jason tells the backstory of the campaign and the people who fought for his release. You can listen to that on Spotify. Thank you both.
Thank you.
You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. If you missed any part of this episode or want to catch up on other international stories, you can download our podcast. Just search for World Affairs, that's one word, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back with Jason Rezaian, columnist for The Washington Post, author and podcaster. He was held in an Iranian prison for 544 days. And 544 Days is the name of a new Spotify original podcast where Jason tells the story of his incarceration and also of the extraordinary and coordinated campaign to free him.
I was a high-profile journalist from a major news organization taken hostage in the middle of once-in-a-generation negotiations.
Jason says most Americans held captive in Iran or in other countries don't have nearly the same visibility.
I'm now part of this weird fraternity, a group that didn't choose to be together and would love nothing more than to add no new members.
I'm Sam Goodwin. I was detained on false charges of espionage in Syria for 63 days.
Kylie Moore Gilbert. Imprisoned in Iran for 804 days.
I am Wang Xiyuan. I was held as American hostage in Iran's Evin prison for 1,216 days.
My name is Nizar Zakkar. I spent 1,362 days as hostage in Evin prison in Iran.
My name is Alan Gross. I was held hostage in Cuba for 1,837 days.
Man, my son is Adolf.
Jason says his mission now is for those names and the names of all the innocent people held captive by foreign governments to remain in the spotlight until they're all freed.
And we have to make clear, I mean, there are hundreds, perhaps thousands of Americans being held on real charges in countries around the world. This is not what we're talking about. We're talking about people who are being held for the purpose of extracting something from the U.S. government.
Right now, there are more than 40 U.S. nationals who are being held hostage by foreign governments.
That's Kate Woodson, one of Jason's colleagues at The Washington Post. With support from the Pulitzer Center, they've created a multimedia project called Bring Them Home. It looks at the particular subset of Americans who've been abducted and held hostage abroad, who haven't been taken by criminal gangs or terrorist groups, but by state actors, national governments. Kate, what's the difference, and why does it matter?
These Americans are being held as diplomatic pawns. They're being held to persuade the U.S. to change policy, offer concessions, or do prisoner swaps. So currently, the U.S. administration refers to them as wrongful detainees because they have been wrongfully detained. It is a separate bureaucratic process from the way the United States deals with hostages held by militant groups, terrorists, etc. But one of the reasons why we call them state hostages is because the United States, we think, needs to change policy in its approach to dealing with hostage diplomacy. Until we start to name what is happening, we won't respond with the right tools to solve it.
Jason, how important is language in all of this? When recently, in the wake of the assassination of the Haitian president and the real chaos in that country, an organized criminal gang kidnapped people connected with a Christian aid organization.
A gang in Haiti has kidnapped a group of 17 missionaries, including three children. A voice message sent to various religious missions said that the people were kidnapped as they were leaving an orphanage. A message.
We have no problem using kidnapped and hostage in that case, but when a representative of a government, as in your case, arrests somebody, puts them in jail without trial, without charge, we wouldn't call it kidnapped. And we wouldn't call that person a hostage. Is that important?
I think it's extremely important. I understand that it's difficult for any administration, and particularly the Biden administration, because it is filled with so many people who have years, if not decades, of experience working within the system as it's been and look at this problem of wrongful detentions not as hostage taking. They look at it as a consular matter. They're not convinced of what Kate and I are talking about. And even if they are, they believe that there's no answer to the problem. So I understand that it might be difficult for officials like that to drop the diplomatic niceties that they've become accustomed to. But if they're serious about wanting to put an end to the problem of state hostage taking, they have to call it that. And I can tell you, Ray, that in my nearly 6 years of talking to officials about this problem since my release, behind closed doors, almost all of them are fine with calling it hostage taking. You put them in front of a podium or a microphone, and they talk about Americans being wrongfully detained. The main distinction between these kinds of terrorist kidnappings, hostage takings, and government ones, invariably, the government wants something in exchange. They want that person alive so that they can be used in some kind of swap later. That's not always the case with the terrorist organization. And as we found out in our research on the subject, the likelihood of someone being held hostage by a government coming home alive is much higher. But the likelihood of them spending years and years in captivity is also much higher.
Jason, the wonderful multimedia project that the Post put together on this topic says more countries are taking Americans hostage and, quote, the U.S. is losing its ability to stop it. Why?
There's multiple reasons for that. I mean, first and foremost, as Kate indicated, we don't have the right structure to even talk about these cases. Traditionally, the way that we've talked about these cases and the way we've handled them has been through consular channels, through diplomatic channels. So the conversation about them is very diplomatic in tone and very bureaucratic in tone. And for that reason, these things can stretch on for very long periods of time.
And it really does the countries that are doing it kind of a favor, because we're acting as if these things are normal and giving them the ability to cape using law.
That's exactly right. And so we, as a country that grounds our worldview in the idea of rule of law, are up against countries who do not respect the rule of law at all. Their judiciaries are not independent from their central governments. They're taking orders from other bodies of the government. Another part of it is that we have our own very nasty history of not abiding by our own concept of rule of law in certain types of cases, right? So after 9/11, the idea that one's Miranda rights or due process could be suspended if they're being accused of terrorist acts or threats to national security, that's something that other countries are now doing and emulating. And I can tell you, oftentimes while I sat in Evin prison, when I complained about my treatment or my lack of access to an attorney and basic rights, they would look me in the eye and say, hey, we're not treating you as bad as you treat people in Guantanamo. And I had very few responses for that. So,
yeah, really, what do you say?
You know, what do you say?
Kate Woodson, which countries are using this form of detention or hostage taking or kidnapping?
Iran, of course, is one of the primary users of this tool, this weapon. Venezuela, Russia, China, Cuba. You know, China's use of hostage diplomacy has raised flags for U.S. officials in a way that other countries' use of it hasn't, because obviously China is such a massive player and probably one of our biggest adversaries. And so now that it has started engaging in this, the United States is realizing that it needs to change its footing. It's not just an Iran problem.
One thing I want to add to it is the number of cases, as they grow and as more countries get involved in this, and as the citizens of other democratic allies of ours, the UK, Canada, Australia, Germany, France, Austria, are also targeted for this kind of hostage taking. As the caseload grows, my big concern is that the kind of very essence of what it means to be a citizen of one of these countries is going to change. When you leave your own country and go abroad, we're sending the message that you're on your own, right? And so this idea that we all had that I'm an American, you can't do this to me, is being turned on its head.
I was in Uzbekistan, interviewing members of the vestigial opposition there, let's say. And suddenly, the windows are thrown open, the doors are busted down, and we're basically mobbed by secret police. And they wanted to seize our passports. And there was a moment where I thought, I'm an American. This is going to be okay. I hear you saying that maybe you shouldn't have that idea anymore.
I'm that guy that's here to tell you that I had that idea my whole life, and I don't have it anymore.
And one of the reasons why we talked about, or wrote about, why the U.S. is losing its ability to stop this type of hostage diplomacy or deter it is because, one, the U.S. is losing its standing in the world. And two, internal politics in the United States often are more of a mountain to climb than negotiations with a foreign actor.
You talked with Brian Jenkins from RAND. He's been tracking this for a while. What did he tell you in your reporting?
Brian Jenkins has so much knowledge about this issue going back to the Nixon administration when he was a young RAND Corporation analyst who was tasked with figuring out how you bargain over human life. That's what they asked him to do. And he's been following it very closely. One of the things that he told me was that the no concessions policy that the U.S. and other governments have adhered to over the years is always broken, right? If somebody's going to become home safely, there's almost always concessions involved. He also told me that, you know, this is not a question of raising prices. You know, if a case is being talked about in the media, that it's going to raise the cost. There's no indication that that's the case. There's no indication that offering concessions has a direct impact on whether or not there's going to be more or fewer cases in the future. You have to deal with each one of these cases individually. You have to resolve them. And the political costs of not resolving them are usually higher than the costs of offering some kind of concession to bring Americans home.
But they've kind of got the country, the home country of the hostage, over a barrel. There's, in some cases, not a lot of leverage. And in some cases, those countries really want things, trade deals, nuclear deals. They want give in other areas, and they might be risk-averse about messing that up by calling them hostages, calling them kidnapped victims, really showing their eye teeth about this case in the international arena.
For me, the first priority in all of these cases is bringing my fellow American home as quickly and as safely as possible. The other priority, which is just as important, is for the government of the U.S. and allied countries who deal with this problem to figure out reliable deterrences to make it costlier in the future for other governments that are involved in taking hostages from doing it in the future. I think a lot of people in this administration and in previous administrations believe those two goals are mutually exclusive. I personally don't. I think that there are deterrents available. We have legal deterrents available. But what has been missing so far is the political will to enact them. And that's what's made it proliferate so much over the last few years.
I mean, hostage taking is not going to stop. This is a really simple way to get something. And so it's going to keep going. But Secretary of State Blinken has said that he wants to create an international declaration, much like the one that was made against the use of chemical weapons, to compel countries around the world to make it such a gross violation of international standards that everybody would unite against the country using chemical weapons.
It's time to send a clear message to every government that arbitrarily detains foreign nationals and tries to use them as leverage. This will not be tolerated by the international community.
Blinken wants that same type of process to happen with state hostage taking. So rhetorically, he is saying the right things. This Biden administration rhetorically is committed to the type of deterrence that Jason has outlined are needed. But in practice, it appears that they are putting that long-term goal over the short-term cases that are on the table right now, that they're putting policy over people. And a very recent example of that is Danny Fenster.
Has been sentenced to 11 years in a Myanmar prison, according to his attorney. The editor of the local Frontier Myanmar was arrested back in May as he tried to leave the country, accused of incitement and unlawful association with an illegal group.
He's a journalist who was held on bogus charges. His release was negotiated by former diplomat and New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson and Mickey Bergman. They negotiated the release by meeting four times with the military leader of Myanmar, and essentially helping to pave the way for humanitarian aid from the UN and other agencies that Myanmar desperately needed. And in return, Danny was freed. That was done outside of the government. It wasn't done by the Biden administration, and it could have been. So the different agendas not only are in different agencies of the government, but of course in Congress as well. If the Biden administration wants to make a deal with Iran, eventually will help free Americans and prevent a nuclear weapon from being built, he is going to get so much heat from Republicans, as Obama did when he made a deal that helped free Jason. And so there is a fear, and particularly now, we are so tribal that any administration is going to be calculating what the other party is going to say and do in response to their effort to free an American.
I want to give a little bit of credit, though, to a growing number of members of Congress who understand that this is not a partisan, should not be a partisan issue. Democrat, Ted Deutsch and Republican French Hill started something they call the Hostage Task Force in Congress to look at these issues.
They say that hostages are not hostages, but these people are not detained under a legal order. They have lost their freedom.
These families deserve certainty and recovery of their loved one, Mr. Speaker.
And, you know, I've been pleasantly surprised at how much support some of these cases have been getting from people from both sides of the aisle. Iran, of course, is a hot potato politically and very divisive, especially within Congress. But I think the issue as a whole of hostage taking and state hostage taking in particular, which, you know, I have to give us some credit for being able to come out and say that loudly and talk about this issue in those terms. There's a growing awareness, understanding, and sense of urgency that I don't think existed a year ago.
Are any of these people closer to having their cell door open? Has there been progress? Is there forward movement in some of these cases?
I have to give you an anecdotal answer. The day that Danny Fenster was convicted, I spoke to his brother, Brian, who told me that today's the worst day of our lives, and it's the worst day of Danny's life. 4 days later, he was on a plane coming home. So it's hard to say. In my case, I was told 10 days before I was released, I was about to be released. I think that each one of these cases is on its own timeline, and I hope that all of them are resolved as quickly as possible. I will say that in the first year of their administration, the Biden folks have not done a great job on this issue. Trump, for whatever you think of him, was able to free quite a number of Americans who were being held hostage in different parts of the world, almost because of his transactional approach to bilateral relations. And as Kate indicated earlier, this administration seems to be putting policy over people, and people are suffering because of it. And as someone who is a victim of one of these hostage takings, the damage that it does to the individual, to their families, to their communities, and to their futures is something that no one should have to experience and that people should know more about.
That's Jason Rezaian and Kate Woodsum. Their project is called Bring Them Home. You can check it out at wapo.st/statehostages. Kate Woodsum is a documentary filmmaker and senior producer of reported analysis and opinions for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us on World Affairs.
Thank you for having us.
And Jason Rezaian is a global opinions writer for The Washington Post. He was the paper's correspondent in Tehran before he was arrested and held in an Iranian prison for 18 months. He wrote about that experience in the 2019 book Prisoner and in his new podcast, 544 Days. Jason tells the backstory of the campaign and the people who fought for his release, and you can listen to that on Spotify. Jason, great to see you again.
It's always a pleasure, Ray. Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening to Jason Rezaian's story, please join us for a live in-person event with Jason and special guests featured in the podcast. That will take place February 23rd at 5:30 p.m. at the World Affairs Center. You can register on our website at worldaffairs.org. Special thanks to Spotify, Crooked Media, and A24 for excerpts from Jason's podcast, 544 Days. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. Today's episode was produced by Andrew Stelzer and Matteo Schimpf. It was edited by our executive producer, Joanne Jennings. Elise Manoukian is our associate producer. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Philip Young is our CEO. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for joining us.